月龄面容的记录。
Effort here this evening and add in your presence. I'm sitting in for Marianne, who is with her grandsons this week. So we bless her in with her family time. And let us begin to dedicate and consecrate our time together in the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the holy, living, and indwelling Trinity. Amen. Now we'll begin to prepare our bodies, our minds, our emotions, our attention, and intention for our time in silence and Lectio Divina. So I invite you to begin to scan your body, feeling any tension, and relaxing and letting go, especially the small muscles of the face, neck and shoulders. Any tension in the solar plexus. The bottom, the legs, the calves, the feet. Scanning, feeling into relaxing. Recollecting. And now turning your attention to the breath. Take some time to deepen your breath. And perhaps practicing the 4-7-8 breath, or whatever breath practice, even if just simply breathing deeply and slowly and exhaling slowly. Using the breath to consciously sink in become more present, more whole. Letting go of whatever has come before. What might come after? Just resting here and now. I am. I am. open, receptive. Now move to our time of Visio and Lectio Divina with excerpts in today's event, which I'll share on the screen. The Lord's compassion does not fail. The Lord's mercy is new every morning. I can strive to have in my ordinary being existence everything satisfying and really necessary for my planetary body. Taking rest, I can replenish the centers and the connection between centers. Taking rest, I can be provided with new perspectives, insight, and relationship to life. Taking rest in centering prayer, I rest in God energy, and my whole being body is replenished. Taking rest, I can listen to higher influences, be attuned to my time body, and present for the voice of the future. The Lord's compassion does not fail. The Lord's mercy is new every morning. I can strive to have in my ordinary being existence everything satisfying and really necessary for my planetary body. Taking rest, I can replenish the centers and the connection between centers. Taking rest, I can be provided with new perspectives, insight, and relationship to life. Taking rest in centering prayer, I rest in God energy, and my whole being body is replenished. Taking rest, I can listen to higher influences, be attuned to my time body, and present for the voice of the future. The Lord's compassion does not fail. The Lord's mercy is new every morning. I can strive to have in my ordinary being existence everything satisfying and really necessary for my planetary body. Taking rest, I can replenish the centers and the connections between centers. Taking rest, I can be provided with new perspectives, insight, and relationship to life. Taking rest in centering prayer, I rest in God energy, and my whole being body is replenished. Taking rest, I can listen to higher influences, be attuned to my top body, and present for the voice of the future. Amen. And now we take time to share in community how the Spirit to us in word, image, or silence, what shimmered in our consciousness. So if you feel called to share, please raise your digital hand. Marcia.
Hi, Pamela and everyone. The first time I heard that, I kind of had a momentary shock at the word "I can" do this, because I had actually read in the email where some of those things said they don't think they can be done. But as the second two readings, I really placed the emphasis on, yes, they can be done if I take the rest I need. And that just brought joy, thinking that things that one thought or one thinks cannot be done, can be done with conscious effort and rest. So, thanks.
Amen. Thank you, Marcia. Steve, please.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi.
Well, what rang through this passage was the first Obligonian striving, and I always skip over the first Obligonian striving. I just don't acknowledge it. because I'm a one that ignores the body type that ignores his body. So I just skip over it. It's like, it's irrelevant. And I probably drive my body and push it and don't respect it. And now as I'm getting older, I realize it's pushing back. And so the thing about really encountering the higher centers is you first have to bring together all the three centers, and you have to connect them. And the body is a very obedient center. You have to bring it in. And I'm trying to be a little bit more compassionate towards that center and to invite it into the, it's like, it's always this little collusion between the emotional center and intellectual center. And the body center is just over there looking up. Hey, what about me? But at any rate, it struck me that way.
Thank you, Steve. Rebecca.
Hello, Pamela.
Hi.
I just love that reading. It just made me feel enveloped in love and I thought about when I had not been coming to the church for very long, and I met with Barbara, and we were talking about centering prayer, and she said, you know, some people picture, or they're, when they do centering prayer, they envision themselves climbing into the hands of the divine and sitting there. And I have always loved that image as well, and often use it. And it just makes me feel exactly like that reading did, which is all is well, all is very, very well, relax. And so I think I'll just leave it there.
Amen. Thank you, Rebecca. Margaret.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi.
What rung out when I read the passage is the part that said everything, existence in everything satisfying and really necessary for my planetary body. And then I thought of food, also sleep, but food that we've been looking at this past week, and consciously eating food, and which I've been practicing all week, eating outside with my dog at my feet, looking at the nature kind of slows me down and helps me eat food with a conscious state of mind, but also being thankful and being grateful and realizing, like J.G. Bennett said, it's a open account, our debt that we have when we eat food, because we have to remember where it came from and to use that food for energy. And so I started thinking about that too. And I loved it. It was a lovely, lovely passage.
Thank you so much, Margaret. Jack or Jackie?
Good evening, Pamela. How are you?
Hi.
The Visio Divino was most overwhelming in a way, and just very refreshing. When I opened up the email this morning, that just took me. The image of the moon over a body of water is scale for me. And there, we go to South Padre, Jack and I do, to get away when we rarely can do that. And for me, it's for scale, to stand and to be, to stay by the ocean and to know I'm of no significance. And isn't that wonderful? And several years ago, when there was going to be a complete eclipse of the moon, we went there intentionally and watched the moon disappear over the ocean and then reappear. And it was such an extraordinary experience. And ironically, and there's no irony, I don't believe in that, we found a piece of art at South Padre on that trip called Melting Moon, which was a moon melting into the ocean. And it's over our staircase right now. So this visual, it didn't matter. I could have read nothing today. I could not have, I didn't even need to hear what the passage was. This is the real gift of my place and this extraordinary world that we're in, as beautiful as it is, and what a gift it all is. So thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you. Marky.
I have a question that's not necessarily about the Lectio Divina, but it's about the email. And it's the very first line that where Gurdjieff's being quoted, and he says, one thing is definitely known. One of the real leakages, chief leakages of our energy is due to our involuntary tension. And then the rest of the, you know, what he says has to go on with the connections between the three centers. But there was no more, because when I first read that, I related to it, because that's something that I feel like we have to let go of that tension in our body to feel three centered. And I thought that's what I was going to hear more about, but there wasn't anything about it. And, you know, I was just curious if you have any thoughts about that involuntary tension that he mentioned. This is the one of the chief leakages.
Well, what's your experience?
Well, that you have to be, you know, in order to be three-centered, you have to let go of that tension.
And what's your observation of tension in your own body on a given moment?
That is something that I need to be aware of, because it's a real thing, you know. That's a challenge for me, and but I was just curious what Gurdjieff's take on that was, and anyway.
Well, maybe Peter will speak to that later on this evening, but that's part of why we take time in prayer as we begin this class every Thursday, because we all come full of whatever came before this. Mm-hmm. And some of us slide over the finish line at right at the top of the hour, and there's unrealized tension from many, many things, thoughts, emotions, busyness. So it's important to take time and consciously prepare so that we can receive.
Yes.
So each part of this class has an intentional component to help us do that. So thank you for the question. We'll see what may come.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Marky. Whitney, we'll take you as our last one, please.
I too loved the image, and I heard the Lord's mercy and the Lord's compassion, and that bright, soft, shiny moon was emanating that for me, and I saw it as the image, and then the water is the likeness. And then I heard, take rest, take rest, take rest, and I think for myself too, I know when I'm rested, on multiple layers, I'm able to reflect that energy of compassion and of mercy better, so long as I'm rested. Otherwise, it's choppy waters, I would say. So I appreciated the image. Thank you.
Thank you, Whitney. Thank you so much. And thank you all for sharing, and also the container of deep listening. And now we turn to Peter so that he can bless this evening's teaching. Peter.
Thank you, Pamela. It's nice to see you and everyone. And I love that image of choppy waters. That's really so useful, Whitney. Thank you. And yes, Marky, we'll get to that question for sure, hopefully tonight. Let's wish together to explore that tonight, because that's at the heart of something that Gurdjieff is trying to communicate about sleep. Well, before we get into sleep and rest, let's look at our homework for last week and report on what you saw regarding eating. I'm going to share my screen to review and remind us of the homework. Last week, Donald shared a teaching on eating. The week prior, we did postures and gestures. And the week before that, we did breathing. So we're really getting to these aspects of our human existence that we have, in many cases, very little control over. Some of it's very autonomic. Some of it's very, very mechanical. And we may not even be aware of some of the things that we are doing regarding our breathing or postures or gestures, facial expressions. And for some of us, that may be the case with eating, that we're just completely in the dark about how we're eating, why we're eating. For some of us, it might be all too present of an issue for us. We're very well aware of our relationship to food. So this is very personal stuff. So I know inviting you to share is similar to talking about sex energy. This is very personal things, you know, our relationship to our postures, our gestures, our face, our relationship to breathing, our relationship to food, our relationship to sleep. These things are very personal. So we hold that in the container of this community and look forward to hearing what you saw about your relationship to food. I'm just going to focus on this last question. What did you discover this week about your relationship with food and eating? Did anything change? What do you wish to remember and embody? There's a long runway of different ideas there to put on this week and practice. What did you see about your relationship with eating? And just open it up now. Just go ahead and raise your hand digitally and we'll go to Jim right away. Thank you, Jim.
Hi, Peter. So I've been aware that I've used food to comfort myself for years and years and years. I mean, it was something that developed in childhood. Quite honestly, I enjoyed it because, you know, it comforted me. And there was always plenty of it around. Didn't matter where I went, I could find food. And I've been fortunate because I'm tall and so I can hide the impact of it. But I've always wanted to have a different relationship with food. I've done a bit of fasting on a regular basis have had moments of a different kind of experience. But this email this time woke something up inside of me that I'd never seen before. The first part was just the idea of welcoming this honored guest into my being. I had never really understood life to life that way. And the gift that life has. And then the second part that was meaningful for me was the idea that as I was conscious with food, that the food itself could achieve a higher level of meaning and purpose in its journey by being digested in me as I carried forth its contribution in my body into the world to manifest Christ. And so the linkage there was more profound than anything I'd seen before. And so it created in me an aim and a struggle that seems to want to stick with me. I've struggled with it ever since I read the email. And I have come to the place where somebody, I think it was Don Hale in one of the journey schools, talked about the retort and the fusion of heat to combine metals into a alloy of some kind. And I realized that this struggle I'm having with this work is that kind of a thing. And so I'm choosing to stay with it. And I'm choosing to allow the work to come to me. And even though I struggle, the work is coming to me. So I'm really thankful for this particular email.
Well, thank you, Jim, for the vulnerability and honesty of looking at something that's been a part of your life for a long time, getting underneath the hood there and shining the light in there. It's powerful. Any particular insight that landed for you that you learned about yourself when it comes to the impulse to eat, or what particular thing attracts you around food?
Well, yeah, I was a heavy smoker for years. It took me 3 years to quit smoking. And finally, the thing that gave me the ability to quit smoking was I began to see that I had developed a friendship with smoking, and that key relationship was very intimate to me. And that in order to set myself free from it, I had to recognize that I didn't need that friend anymore. And so food has had the same effect. It's comforted me just like cigarettes did. And so beginning to understand that there's a difference in consciousness in relating to food seems to be more powerful than that, just that tempting, comforting feeling that I've had.
Beautiful. And if you don't mind, just probing with one more question, if you don't mind. And it's okay if you haven't seen this. So just, I think it would be illuminating for all of us to hear. But I'm wondering if you were able to observe a particular center that co-opts this experience, or that takes control of this experience. Is there a particular center that you've observed?
Oh, yeah, working? It's the emotional center. Yeah, it's the emotional center. It has a built-in codependence with food, and they're buddies. It immediately grabs a hold of my body and aligns with the feeling of the anticipation of being satisfied.
Gosh, thank you so much. That's really helpful, very useful, probably universal in experience. So thank you, Jim. Let's go to Cammy, one of our new friends from Northern Wisconsin. Cammy, welcome.
Hi, Peter. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm looking over here because I have my TV set up too. So sorry about that. Jim, I really appreciated your reflection and it made a connection for me. So I'm a little distracted, because what I wanted to share was just the focus on eating and then being prayerful about our eating in a culture that is just so fast and often doesn't reserve time to make that sacred connection to what we consume. And I don't have a very good memory, but I have a memory sealed in my head of a mature couple in a small diner in a small town in Wisconsin, who the wife went to a bar to get her husband food, and he needed assistance, didn't move agilely, so he went and sat at a table. She went and got his food, and brought it to him. And he sat in front of his food and waited while she returned to the bar and got her food. And then she came back to the table, and then the two of them sat together, and it was obvious that they took a pause to pray. Mm-hmm. And that image came to me as I read the email about eating and just what we're denying ourselves in connection to the source of food, the preparation of food, the communion of food, how it brings together those who share the food. And it just really woke up a desire for me to want to experience that on a more regular basis.
Thank you, Cami. Yep. Mr. Gurdjieff in the work tradition used food and meals significantly. And I think the email hints at that too, but it's pretty amazing the power of food in our lives as individuals and as families and communities, so spiritually and physically. Thank you, Cami.
Yes.
That's a powerful image. Jack or Jackie, please.
Oh, so I unmuted? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's the question of the century, I guess. I was at physical therapy today, and I was filling out a form after my hip replacement. And this is the first time I came to health issues, and I checked yes for obesity. It was a very truthful check, and it really brought me to focus. So two things. My type, my sin is gluttony. And it's not just food, it's not just drinks, it's just everything, wanting everything I can get. And I've traced this back to being raised in a family of six, one wage earner. I was the youngest. My mother made extraordinary meals. She was known for that. But she made meals that were just enough for six. And so there was, she would say, bless her heart, the chicken back is the best part of the chicken. The chicken back. And so when the chicken was divided up amongst six, she would take the back. And that puzzled me. And so I finally ate a back. It's a crappy piece of chicken. But she was so loving that she allowed the rest of us to take the really good parts. And so I first really thought of that when I was self-remembering, self-observation, going to to church at the 9 o'clock meal, and always trying to be the first one in the line. And I saw it so vividly that I was that little boy at a table that had some really good food in front of him, but he wanted to make sure he got what was on the table. And and there's nothing spiritual about that at all. It was just fundamentally getting what I can get. And I've actually been able to wait for about 8 or 9 people to get ahead of me now. So I'm really making progress there. But from the real standpoint of this thing, food has been a way for me to really self-observe. And there's a wish to not click obesity in the future. And there's a wish to figure that out.
Well, beautiful wish. Thank you, Jack, for sharing that and the vulnerability and honesty of seeing that and putting it outside of yourself, like that on a paper form. And everybody is different, and everybody can handle food differently and drink differently. So we can't judge. We can observe other people's behavior with food. So bravo, and cheers to your health and longevity and well-being. I think that image of rushing, you know, being greedy and rushing to get your share of food or whatever, is a universal experience. I've always found it interesting to watch movies or read stories about people who are starving, and then food gets delivered and they become like animals, just going crazy for the food. And it just teaches me that there's something very primitive and instinctual around food that the front brain can't control, especially when we're hungry. I don't think it's justification for gluttony or whatever, but it is very interesting to see how the animal part of us kicks in around food, especially if we've been denied food for a long time, or how people eat when they've been denied food for a long time. You know, they just grab it with their hands or whatever, or even just bite into a fish if they're really starving. And there's a lot to learn at the edge of hunger and beyond hunger when we start to feel the diminishment of health. And after 2 or 3 weeks of fasting and beyond, you know, what crazy behavior kicks in sometimes when we are that hungry. So nice, polite people all of a sudden denied some food become
food fight.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for that insight. I see Gay has had her hand up once or twice now. So Gay, please. Gay Bullard. You're muted. Gay, you're muted.
There we go.
There you go.
Am I unmuted now?
We can hear you now.
Okay, thank you. I learned so much about myself this week that I really had not expected to learn from this, because when the homework was presented about eating and about food, I have always had a sort of an underlying attitude that I love food and anything about food, you know, like reading about it even, and shopping for it, planning meals. And since I'm single, I eat most of my meals alone, which in some ways it's a really good thing, because I got to really observe some things about me and my attitude about food. I love to cook. I cook carefully for myself. And one thing I learned from the homework was that a lot of my relationship with food has to do with the health benefits of it. What is good to eat, what's not good to eat, what the latest information is about, you know, fat, about this and that. And I've always had a little bit of pride about the fact that I eat properly. What I didn't observe, however, was I had gotten into the habit of keeping a book at the table. So I go to all this trouble to prepare a lovely meal. I put it on the placemat, knife, fork, spoon, something to drink. It's lovely. I open the book and I don't even realize what I'm eating. I'm simply shoveling it in my mouth. So I made an aim this week that the book was going, and I was going to do some of the exercises that were suggested. One of which Donald suggested was that first bite that I put into my mouth, that I become very conscious of that, of the taste, the texture, the actual relationship with it, which I had never considered before. My relationship with food was always, is this good for me? Is this healthy for me? I never really thought about the food itself that was going into my mouth. So there was something, I think it was in the homework, that said, in effect, that I am like heaven for the food. So I put it in my mouth, I begin to chew it, it becomes more liquid, I swallow it, and I presume it goes into my stomach, where it becomes even more liquid, and eventually becomes part of my blood. So that gave me some meat to really ponder as I was eating. Now, here's another thing I observed very quickly was I could not maintain my attention with that for the whole meal. My mind would start to wander. Today, what I realized was that I become impatient to get through, to get done. So I learned so much about myself.
Yeah, sounds that way. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Very universal too. So thank you for sharing, especially the part about where's our attention while we're eating, watching. Are we watching something? Are we reading something? And versus delighting in each particular bite. Thank you, Gay. It's a beautiful witness to the homework. Let's go with Cynthia, who rarely reports. Cynthia, welcome. Thank you for sharing.
Yes. Hi, Peter and everybody. I have kind of a different take on it, so I thought I would share. At a very young age, well, young at college, I decided to become a vegetarian because I was, you know, a hippie and didn't want to harm any animal. And since that time, I have had a very conscious and intimate relationship about with my food and what I eat. And my whole family is that way. We can get around a table and have discussions about health and food, etc. I spent time fasting. I've spent a year on eating nothing but raw food, very extreme things like this. So when I saw the email, I thought eating, oh, I know about eating. But I learned a lot, very significant things from this lesson, because all the time that my I was interested and focused on eating and food, it was very self-centered. It was all about me, my health, how I'm going to feel, my energy, all of those sorts of things. And I never really realized how holy the food is and what it is giving to me. A long time ago, years ago, I decided to be conscious when I was preparing food. So I will pray, light a candle, prepare the food. But in eating, I didn't do that. I was still stuck on this level of this food is me and I'm doing this for me. I began to see that it was life coming in my life that I may give out life. I began to see the circle of what this food was doing. It didn't stop at my level at all. And I've been missing that completely. And when I began to be quiet and thankful and concentrate and think about what all this food, where it came from, how it landed on my table, how I was consciously eating it, what came to me was my great compassion for those that do not have, because it seemed like such a rich feast that was given to me. And I felt really full very quick because I was conscious with the food and conscious of what all that came in to give me. And it became a focus for my spiritual work, my journey. This is what this food is for, something higher bypassing me in respect. So thank you.
Thank you. Imagine that, you know, shining consciousness in something that in this way leads to a positive emotion like gratitude. Imagine that. So thank you for sharing your work. Let's go to Sue, and then if you can both be brief, we can have Leanne as well share. If you guys can be brief, and just get to the point of what you saw in your work this week. Thank you. Go to
yes.
Sue, I guess. Yes.
So I observed a lot of resistance in myself to just being present while I was eating. There was a great desire to be doing something else while I was eating. And it was really, really hard for me to not do that. And listening to the discussion tonight, the insight I'm getting is that that is a clue for me when I'm not able to, when I have such resistance to being present, that my nervous system is overwhelmed. And that might be the time for me to use some of those tools, you know, that we got earlier in the year and some other tools that I have on hand to care for my nervous system. And then I'll be able to be more present with food as well as other things in my life. So that was a really helpful insight that I got from listening to all of y'all talk just now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue, for sharing. And one thing I'll just share is, you know, when we get into those situations with food, drinking a glass of water is amazing how that shifts as well. It's a practice we haven't talked about, but it drinking a glass of water is definitely a practice for us as a culture. We don't drink enough water. Thank you, Sue. Leanne.
Hi. I just want to kind of continue what Gay was saying, or reiterate, or not even reiterate, but continue from where her observations of eating alone and the preparation and the involvement in the food. And for a long time, I really paid close attention to this. And I don't know if it's because of COVID ending and all of a sudden, for me, fast food is available or faster food. I never was going out. And now all of a sudden I can go out. And so the idea of the focus of food has really been lost. And this email really brought attention to that. And it also made me very aware that our food preparation, our eating, is a way that we can be called to a prayer. It is like the Muslims that have that prayer period five times a day. We have this opportunity to have a prayer period four times or three times a day. And so that's what was I was reminded of. Thank you.
I'm glad you paired that with prayer. That's a beautiful transition for us. But I was just thinking as you were sharing, you know, that food and paying attention to our food takes an effort. Just like looking up and paying attention to the stars and what's happening in the cosmos. And similarly, taking effort to look at our postures and our breath. It all just is a way of helping us become more conscious and attentive to ourselves. So thank you for that. It's amazing how the different changes and seasons of life give different opportunities to see different things about ourselves. And none of it really needs to be judged. It just is. It just is different. Thank you, Leanne. Thank you, everyone, for sharing. It was good work. I appreciate that. It's useful for all of us to hear the common human journey with food. So we'll continue tonight with our lesson regarding sleep and rest. I'm going to share the screen here, and we'll move forward into today's lesson. As I mentioned, you know, we're getting into these things that are so personal in terms of our daily life. But what we do daily, we can sometimes do dully. I think that's a statement that Donald Jung made. I like that. What we do daily, we can do dully. And so it gives us opportunity to do some work in these things that are so close to us. They're so close because they're so much a part of our life. So as Marky indicated, that quotation from Gurdjieff was very powerful. And it began with that one statement about the problem with energy being spent by these unconscious constrictions. And in general, many people would say that the first part of the work, the teaching of the work, is to become aware of oneself to such an extent that you're consciously spending your energy. That would be a good definition of the work. And from my perspective, that these practices and exercises are all helping us become more conscious of how we're spending our energy and what energies we're using and where our energies are in the body, et cetera, which center they're in. So the leakages that happen through this mindless, you know, for example, foot tapping or gesturing of the hands or facial tics or even facial constrictions, you know, sometimes you can just express a lot of tension. The muscles can be contracted in an unconscious way, or just notice how often your feet are moving, or your toes are moving, almost unconsciously. So all of that's leakage of energy and the constrictions in the body of energy, whether it's tightness of muscles, tightness in the back, in general, the system's not relaxed. So what he is getting at here in this email, though, about sleep, and I pulled out this one quotation, it's two sentences, but I think it's just brilliant and very useful. And this can be found in Views from the Real World, his book. And he said that a person's sleep is nothing else than interrupted connections between centers. So that led me to the understanding that sleep is the absence of something. It's the disconnection of something. Kind of like night is the absence of the sun. It disconnects from our sky, our visible sky. And so what is being disconnected? And he has this theory of the various centers, as you're all well aware. So the connections between the centers are somehow getting disconnected or interrupted. And that helps us go to sleep. So tonight we're going to just be focusing on physical sleep. We're not going to talk about the work principle or of psychological sleep. So we're just focused on actual sleeping in bed or at night when we're resting. And what the other side of his statement here that I found so intriguing and extraordinary, really, his definition of sleep is a person's centers never sleep. So the system isn't sleeping, even though your body is asleep. So the centers are awake. And I think that perhaps some centers are more awake or online than others. But it'd be interesting to see how that sentence and that idea squares with modern neuroscience and physiology. But I think there's something that really resonates deeply in my own experience that even when I have been asleep, I can feel and sense that there are different parts of me, whether it's an emotional center or an intellectual center, less the intellectual center, but certainly dreams or an awareness that I'm sleeping is a fascinating experience that suggests maybe the centers never sleep. I think from a theoretical point of view, that's very intriguing. What does it mean for you and for your life and a lived day-to-day experience? It would just be interesting to see and study yourself as you nap or try to go to sleep. Is it true that sleep is the disconnection of the centers, even if the centers never go to sleep? Here's some further kind of teaching about this. This is from a fellow by the name of Paul Beekman Taylor. Paul Beekman Taylor was born in 1930, and he lived at the Priory in Fontainebleau as a little boy, and he had experiences with Mr. Gurdjieff and the community there. From a child's perspective, he was a student of Gurdjieff as he became a young adult, studied with Mr. Gurdjieff in Paris in his late teens, and obviously was there when Mr. Gurdjieff died. And then Paul Beekman Taylor has written several books about Mr. Gurdjieff. So here's a quotation from one of his writings. I'll just read it. I remember one talk about sleep. Mr. Gurdjieff said that children slept too long, that 6 hours should be enough once we learn to sleep efficiently. He said that one could sleep even during the day, and mentioned that there were ways of measuring efficiency of sleep. One means was to hold a pencil between the fingers, doze off, and when the pencil dropped, that was enough of a nap. If you slept too long, he explained, you dream. And when you dream, you do not gather energy efficiently, might even lose energy. So we'll come back to that. Also necessary in putting oneself soundly to sleep is transferring force or energy from one center to another. One can do this by emptying the mind of thought and the body of feeling and movement. So Marky, this kind of gets at what your question was. And this is kind of one of his practices. Start by remembering and then forgetting the head or the sensation of the head in order to diffuse mental energy throughout the rest of the body. And then do the same downward through the rest of the body until concentration exists through the toes. And then rather than the word concentration, I would use the word sensation. You can also do this starting with the toes and moving up. And my mom used to put me to sleep this way. Peter, your toes are feeling heavy. Now your foot is heavy. It's sinking into the bed. And now your calves are heavy. And she would lead me through that. And it was a way of shutting down the system or disconnecting the centers in a very subtle and powerful way. So let's go back to the claim here about dreaming and just say, interesting, Mr. Gurdjieff, when you dream, you do not gather energy efficiently. So remember, Mr. Gurdjieff was teaching before the era of neuroscience and electrophysiology and functional MRIs and all of the studies of the brain and sleep research that's just been occurring in the last 20 or 30 years. But nevertheless, something of what he says is congruent with all the modern neuroscience and sleep research, which basically has confirmed that there isn't just one type of sleep. There's multiple types of sleep. The primary two types of sleep they call REM sleep or REM sleep, and then they have an NREM sleep, N as in Nancy, REM sleep. And it's that NREM sleep that is the deepest sleep of all that happens toward the, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock hour of the morning after a long night's sleep, that one experiences the dreamless states. And so that's where we tend to get the deepest sleep, is not just in that REM sleep, but in that deepest dreamless sleep. So there's something to what he's saying here that's been confirmed, that there are different types of states of sleep, and that we really sleep in 90-minute circles or cycles. And they've basically measured that out. So as you're coming up to the end of the 90 minutes, you're coming, you know, closer to the surface of consciousness, and you resume that 90-minute cycle. So I think his intuition here is that if you dream, or when you dream, you might even be losing energy or not gathering energy, is actually quite accurate. So if you're never getting down to those deeper levels of sleep, REM sleep, you're just staying on the surface where some of the more simpler dreams that you don't remember exist. So something to his teaching, there's always some wisdom to it, even without the scientific basis, and it tends to get confirmed later on as science unfolds. Very intuitive insight. So we'll just move from Mr. Gurdjieff now, and just if you have any questions, just hold them. We'll pause in a second. And just I want to conclude the thought here on centers and connections and the practice of actually not sleeping, because Mr. Gurdjieff's definition of sleep is the disconnection of the centers. And so this is just a different spin on that, and that is the practice of not sleeping as a way of being in relationship to our centers or the connections between our centers, and what happens when we practice fasting from food and also fasting from sleep. But why would we do this? Well, in part because there is an energy to be gained when we consciously and intentionally give ourselves the permission and the power to not sleep. And one of the insights of the monastic tradition and all the spiritual traditions is not to deny the body because the body's bad, but to use denial or abstinence of sleep, for example, or minimization of sleep to teach us what's really in control and how much there is a deeper, fuller power or real I or master, however you wanted to talk about it, that actually can transcend the physical sensations of sleepiness, tiredness, the body being weary and worn, that there's actually a strength that is beyond the centers, especially the instinctive moving center, that is wanting sleep so badly. And this strength that comes, whether it's master or real I, that can take control of the body in a very powerful and useful way. is real. So there is a practice of not sleeping. Jesus practiced this, it seems, very regularly. And he's one of many people throughout history that we're aware of who consciously chose not to go to sleep at night, but to go away from and go into solitude and go particularly at night and pray. And oftentimes late into the night, there's indications that he was praying early in the morning, you know, like in the 2 hours, 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock hours. So there's a power that one can receive by intentionally not sleeping. And that is part of the gift of sleep as well, is learning how to use our sleep, particularly in certain periods of our life when perhaps we're needing to make a decision or struggling with something that we want spiritual strength for, to contend with a particular type of besetting passion or problem that's in our lives, to stay up and sleep and not sleep is a practice. It's also very humbling, like fasting, when you try to do this, how quickly we give in. And we know that we need each other, spiritually speaking, to practice these types of things. And that's the gift of spiritual community. These are the monks, the beloved monks of New Camaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur, California, preparing for Mass, for Eucharist, on a Sunday morning. And you can see this beautiful community. They support one another, and they do so by intentionally structuring their prayer life around the hours of the day. They call it the prayer of the hours or the divine office. It's very hard to get up at 3 a.m. by yourself to pray or chant 5 or 6 psalms. But when you're in community and the community is dependent upon you, it gives you a force to get up in the morning and to fight against the normal urge of the body to sleep and to give in. So we strengthen each other in community to realize that we're more than just our physical appetites for food, for drink, for sex, for sleep. We're more than our appetites and our needs for these physical things. The real issue here in the monastic tradition was always the right balance, to be balanced man or woman in our use of the food, drink, sexual energy, and sleep. And most of the wisdom teaching in, for example, the Rule of Saint Benedict, one of the oldest rules for monasteries, was around how much sleep a monk should have and how to arrange the sleeping quarters to support the life of prayer and using energy in a different way than just sleeping all the time. So hopefully that inspires you and gives you something to think about in terms of your own prayer life and how easily it is to just give in to the physical sensation of sleep and to work against that, to take a day, maybe in Lent, take a few days in Lent to strategically and intentionally work against the habit of falling asleep at 9:30 at night or giving into, you know, sleeping, oversleeping. Anyway, these are things to play around with when it comes to our mechanicality. But we need to be careful because sleep is very much an essential thing, and we need to be very cautious about this. There's this powerful passage in the Gospel of Matthew. You're all aware of the prayer in Gethsemane where Jesus is praying by himself. And he comes back several times and his disciples are all sleeping. And he says, "Were you not able to watch with me for 1 hour? Can't you just stay up 1 hour?" And he comes back for the third time and he finally sees that these people are so tired, their eyes are heavy, and he just goes away and keeps praying, gives up asking them to pray with him, and finally concludes the experience saying, "Are you guys still sleeping and resting?" So there's something about the spiritual practice of not sleeping that gives one strength to go through difficult situations. That's the model Jesus gives us. On the eve of his own death, he's not sleeping. To accumulate in himself a force of strength to do what needed to be done, which was quite significant, that self-surrender. So there's something about it, and we don't need to belabor the point, but perhaps you'll feel called to that at some point in your life, to keep vigil with someone, to bear witness, to bear vigil with someone, or for yourself to minimize sleep for a different purpose. Before we go into dreams, I'm just going to stop the share and see if anyone has any particular comments or questions specifically about the Gurdjieff teaching stuff about centers getting disconnected in sleep, and see if there's any questions that have come up at all from what we've talked about so far. Any comments or questions or urges to share? Let's go ahead and raise your hand. Can anyone verify anything that has been said so far? Stephen, please.
Well, I've always been a big advocate of the power nap, usually a mid-afternoon or maybe early afternoon nap, and often done in a chair. And it's so refreshing, and it's a very, I think, efficient use of sleep. I'm not sure what's compressed into that as far as REM sleep versus non-REM sleep, or, but it just seems like it only takes 15 minutes and you're refreshed. So
yeah, I find that to be true as well. I delight in taking a short nap when I can in the afternoon. Very empowering, very interesting. Lauren, please. Thank you, Steve. You're muted, Lauren.
So, and I try to sell encyclopedias as a teenager, and the encyclopedia salesperson who was teaching me how to do it said, well, I complained about how long it took. And she said, well, you don't need so much sleep. And she told me about dropping the pencil. Instead of dropping a pencil, she said, just get a pan from the kitchen and hold the pan over a hard floor. And when the pan falls, it'll wake you up. And that's all the sleep you need. And for years, I used that technique in college and other places. And a number of people have found it laughable, shall we say. But I remember Buckminster Fuller did some pretty heavy duty work, and he only believed in 3 hours of sleep a night, I think, or something like that. Been many people who've done a lot of productive work who got very little sleep. And so I fought the people who told me you really need 8 hours of sleep. But of late, I have found that I benefit both from the power nap, the 15-minute nap in the afternoon, and also from 8 hours of sleep. But just recently, you didn't say anything about how you might order things, but at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I come up and I have some of my best ideas for poems, for the Church of Conscious Harmony, for all kinds of things, which I may or may not decide to share. But I find that you get a lot of clarity when you wake up in the middle of the night. And I didn't have a lot to do with it in this case.
Yeah, thank you for that. Clarity and cleansing. It's like a cleansing, literally washing through the River Lee, the forgetting of the day before and releasing of the stress and anxieties. It's the body gets awash in those healing chemicals, the chemistry of forgetfulness, which is so essential for well-being. So thank you very much, Lauren. Do share your insights and visions. Susan, don't know which Susan.
Hi. This is Susan Stanbrook. You may not be able to see me because I'm at the Boca Beach, and I have literally gotten to experience what Jackie so beautifully described from her painting, the moon melting into the sea as class was going on. I wanted to witness to the ability to perform well with a small amount of sleep. In the transition moving from Austin to Boca. It has been complicated by my mother's death in Tennessee and many flights and trips back and forth and rental cars and just really being a gypsy, moving locations until I get settled. And I have survived on, I think, one night that I flew into Tennessee, 45 minutes of sleep that night. And the secret that I found is through my yoga practice, and it can be found on YouTube, and it's called, it's a form of yoga nidra developed by Dr. Richard Miller called I Rest with a little tiny I and then R-E-S-T. And these simple meditations of 20 or 30 minutes, depending on what you choose, take you through all of the stages of a deep, restful nap. And they say, according to the yogis, is equivalent to 3 or 4 hours of sleep.
Well, thank you, Susan. I'm going to stop you there. I appreciate that that resource. And send you greetings and peace as you begin your new life there. And I think this is a first, a beach broadcast for a work class. So bless you and your as you begin life there. Jen, I'm going to need to proceed, so we'll see if we have time to come back to you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for sharing. We're just going to conclude by just touching base with dreams and rest. Obviously, when we think of sleep and what's happening in sleep, there is something that's very not practical about sleeping. And some people try and, you know, make most of life and be as productive as possible, and so they don't sleep as much. But there is something that's really beautiful that happens in the gift of sleep, and that's, you know, deep dreams. And so the one aspect of dreaming and sleeping that go hand in hand that I just wanted to highlight was the near quality of revelation or insight or visual impressions that are really the language of higher intellectual center and higher emotional center that come through our dreams. And not just dreams about digesting the day's activities, but what I would call high and holy dreams that come from above, that come from the future, perhaps, that are forewarning you or guiding you or speaking to you about something regarding a discernment or a decision, and to listen to those dreams. Obviously, one of the most famous dreams is Jacob's dream, where he falls asleep with his head on a rock, and he has this extraordinary vision of the angels coming and going up from heaven, and he dedicates that place as a place of meeting God. And it was a definitive moment in his life. Huge stories in the scriptures about different dreams that have come, that have guided whole decisions and shaped whole stories. The dream of the angel coming to Joseph in the dream. What's interesting is that God had to get Joseph's attention in a dream. All the angel had to do was appear to Mary. So Mary didn't even need a dream to get the message. I think that's really interesting, the contrast between Mary and Joseph and their availability to higher influences. Joseph was asleep, Mary was awake. Very interesting contrast. I don't need to go into that, but before we do the homework, I did just want to open it up for any final comments or questions. Jan, we want to come back to you? Jan Brown?
Oh, finally. Hey, Peter, how are you? What I was going to say is, since I was a little kid, sleep was always difficult for me. My household was real chaotic, and, you know, dark things scared me. And so all my life, I've, you know, had trouble with sleep. And since my since my sister's death, that's one of the ways I hid from it, is I would sleep. And sometimes I'd get in my bed and I'd sleep for just way longer. And in the beginning, I'd get in bed and I'd be thinking about how wonderful it felt. And the idea of being able to just melt into as much sleep as I wanted. But by the end of the day, I felt awful. And so, you know, just as people are talking about how they can operate with less sleep, you know, on the other side, the too much sleep, I guess it's the same with food, you know, or with anything that we've been talking about these past weeks. I don't function too well on not much sleep. And the opposite is true there too. You know, it's just, this whole thing has just brought it up to me, that, you know, the opposite, the end, each ends of the pendulum brings its own problems.
Yes, thank you very much. So grief is a huge interrupter of sleep patterns very naturally. And there's just a real gentleness we need to have with ourselves when we're grieving, because it seems to deeply affect people's sleep, either too much or too little. And I think that connects with Gurdjieff's teaching, you know, that grief prevents the emotional center from disconnecting from perhaps the intellectual center. That grieving.
Well, would you say that again?
That grieving prevents the emotional center from disconnecting. Remember, his definition of sleep is the disconnection of centers. So grieving somehow is a stickiness of that emotional center. And I think that may be one explanation from, in the work terms, of why something like grief keeps people awake, or conversely keeps them asleep. So in general, when it comes to grieving, we just have to be super gentle with ourselves and other people, because you know, grief is extraordinarily powerful. In our lives.
Unbelievable. I read in some book in the beginning that insomnia, which is, you know, just problem sleeping, insomnia is universal with grief. Yeah. And, you know, that was comforting to me.
Yeah. And also, thank you for bringing up the childhood stuff, because a lot of us do have childhood traumas and those. The fear of sleep or the fear of the dark. And so just to be gentle with ourselves around that, that stuff is deeply ingrained in our psyche. And we just can't snap our fingers and heal that stuff. It takes time. So thank you, Jan. Margaret, I see your hand, but we're going to just need to conclude. And I'm going to conclude by sharing the homework for this week. I'll just start at the bottom. There's a wonderful video that's linked in your email that Murabi Star talks about the gift of Sabbath keeping. And we didn't get into that tonight, but it's in the email, the role of rest and Sabbath keeping as a spiritual practice. We don't keep Sabbath very well in our culture anymore, but there's a real gift in just giving oneself to a day of rest, being down. And that might mean, you know, that might mean taking a walk in the woods or doing something that renews you, but to practice the Sabbath weekly. We kind of practice Sabbath every day by going to sleep. We give God a certain portion of our day, and we give God a certain portion of our sleep, and it definitely renews us. But Sabbath keeping is a beautiful practice. And then the second one is, what did you discover this week about your relationship to rest? Did anything change? Do you find it easy to take rest? What makes it difficult to take rest? What is your rest work? Where is your work regarding your sleep? And then this week, observe your sleep patterns and rhythms. Is sleep easy for you, or does it evade you? Do you find yourself consciously preparing for sleep, or is sleep random for you, an afterthought? Aim to create a more conscious bedtime ritual, such as not watching TV or a screen in bed, lighting a candle, saying a prayer. What do you observe about your relationship to sleep and rituals? I suspect many of us already have a lot of that wisdom integrated into our daily life, but again, these things are so up close and personal, there's always something more for us to learn and discover as we self-observe uncritically. Thank you all for sharing and being together. It's a beautiful community we get to be a part of. Good night. Pamela?
Thank you, Peter. And so dropping into our hearts, let us pray together the prayer of God's love. God's love has always met and will always meet all our needs. We give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed we are to simply remember God. Amen. And now our Compline prayer, which might be one of the things you consider as a ritual before you go to bed at night, along with monastics and lay contemplatives all over the world. Protect us, Lord, as we stay awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. And may God grant us a quiet night and a peaceful death. Amen.